This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'd like to start today's presentation by just telling a short story about an incident that happened not too far from here, down at Braidwood, back in the 1860s. It involved a police tracker, who was based with the Braidwood Police. There was a band of bushrangers led by the Clark brothers, notorious bushrangers, who'd been responsible for the deaths of four special constables. They'd spent most part of the 1860s rampaging around the gold fields near Braidwood. They'd been robbing the gold escort and duffing cattle. And the governor of the day had put a £5,000 reward on their capture. They were hard to locate, and the police called in the local Braidwood tracker to assist. His name was, most unusually, his name was Sir Watkin Wynne, which is one of the more unusual names for an Aboriginal person in New South Wales that I've come across. Much difference to most of the names that were given to trackers and to Aboriginal men in particular. Usually they were just given a name at that time, like Tommy or Jimmy. But this tracker was known as Sir Watkin Wynne. The origin of the surname, look, I really don't know. There's one of the first editors of the Sydney Telegraph had the name Watkin Wynne, and there are also members of the British aristocracy who were called Sir Watkin Wynne, but I don't know the relationship between them and their name and the tracker. Anyway, Sir Watkin was instrumental in the capture of the Clark brothers. He tracked them to their hideout in the Jingara Range near Braidwood. There was a shootout which Sir Watkin was part of, and some accounts suggest that he was injured, in fact that he lost his arm. But I've only recently just found this wood engraving, and you can actually see Sir Watkin there. He has a bandage around his arm. So whether he lost his arm or not, I'm not sure. But nevertheless, he was very important in the capture of the Clark brothers. Now, for his daring and skill, Sir Watkin, as all other trackers were in 1867, were paid a wage of £45 per year. Now, the most junior constable at the time was receiving £111, so there's a clear wage differential, a clear discrepancy in what Sir Watkin was receiving. So as we all know, over the last decade, there have been schemes established around Australia, not in all parts, sadly, but for the return of stolen wages. There's clear justification for these actions. Protection and welfare boards control the wages of Aboriginal employees and Aboriginal wards, and much of the money, pension money included, was never distributed. But there are other types of government employees as well who may have had their wages withheld or did not receive a fair and decent wage for the work that they did. There's no evidence in New South Wales that I've come across so far that trackers weren't actually given their wage. There is evidence for other states, in Victoria, for example, where trackers were not always paid. So today I want to focus more on the category of the deficient wage that the trackers were paid. They also didn't receive a pension, which is an issue that I'll come back to later on. So trackers were both formally and informally employed in New South Wales before 1862, but the period I'm focusing on today is between 1862 through to around 1950. The New South Wales Police Force was reformed in 1862, and the various branches which had been locally based were brought under centralised control. So there are quite detailed records of the wages paid to police, including trackers, after 1862. This is a little bit hard to see. It's a scan of a photocopy, so it's not all that clear, but it's the police salary register for 1892, and this particular page lists the names of trackers in the western area, central western area of New South Wales, where they were employed and the wages that they were receiving. So this information is on the public record up until about 1915. It's quite detailed records, and it's enabled me to build up a picture of not only what trackers were paid, but where also they were working throughout New South Wales. So there's approximately 200 places, just under 200 places in New South Wales, where trackers were working between 1883 and 1916. Before 1883, the place where trackers were employed wasn't recorded. So this is quite an interesting map. It shows concentrations of tracker employment, mainly in the central and the northwest parts of the state. These are areas where the wider economy was firmly based on sheep and cattle and wheat. One of the roles of trackers, of course, was tracking lost and stolen herds of sheep and cattle. So that certainly explains the concentration of tracker employment in the north and the central parts of the state. Interestingly, few trackers employed along the coast, and also few trackers employed in the Riverina area. I'm yet to develop sort of an adequate explanation, particularly for the Riverina, why fewer trackers were employed down there. So trackers were responsible for a wide variety of work, not just for searching for stolen and lost stock, as we've seen. They were responsible for the capture of bushrangers. They were responsible for tracking and capturing all manner of petty criminals. They also looked for people lost in the bush. They had other important duties as well. They were responsible largely for keeping the police horses in good order. Many of the trackers were skilled stockmen, skilled horsemen. They were also the horse breakers quite often for the police as well. And they actually tended to live at the back of the police station in the stables. This is a picture of one of the few remaining police stables in New South Wales from Coonamble, about 100 kilometres north of Dubbo. Another job that they did from about the 1870s onwards too, trackers were called into court too to give evidence in cases. So there's quite a few newspaper transcripts of trackers giving evidence, talking about how they were able to locate criminals. So what is clear is the trackers were very skilled employees, and the police valued that skill to a certain extent, but not in the sense of receiving fair and equal pay. This is a graph just comparing the wages of trackers and constables from across several years from 1863 to 1915. It's interesting to note, so in 1845, trackers were receiving £45 compared to £111 for constables. 20 years later, the tracker wage had only increased up to £54. And in fact, 20 years after that, it was still stuck at £54. Although in the intervening period for a short while, senior trackers were paid a slightly increased wage, but that system had been removed by 1902. And then there's an interesting... Then the wage almost doubles in the period from 1902 up until 1915. I haven't yet to come across any sort of documentary evidence as to why there was that sudden increase in tracker wages. Nevertheless, they were certainly well below what constables were being paid, certainly well below what sergeants and detectives were being paid. But nevertheless, there was a slight closing of the gap in the years up to 1915. So the Harvester Judgment in 1907 set the minimum wage for unskilled workers in Australia at approximately £127 per annum. So trackers were clearly well below what unskilled workers were being paid in Australia. After 1915, as I said, the records relating to tracker wages and police wages are not on the public record, so I'm having to rely on other information to determine what trackers were being paid. By 1939, quite a famous tracker from New South Wales, tracker Alec Riley, who was based at Dubbo, he was promoted to black tracker first class, and that gave him a wage of £230 per annum. Nevertheless, look, that salary was probably welcome. That salary increase would have been welcome, given it was towards the end of the Great Depression, when all people were experiencing difficult economic conditions. But nevertheless, it was still well below the average wage that was being paid to unskilled workers at the time, which was approximately around £800 per annum. So Tracker Riley's salary was high in Indigenous terms, but yes, still well below what most non-Indigenous men were being paid. Tracker Riley is probably one of the reasons why I got interested in the history of trackers. As I said, he was the tracker at Dubbo, and he worked from about 1911 through to 1950. I grew up in Dubbo, and despite knowing a lot of Aboriginal kids at school, no one really talked about the Aboriginal history of Dubbo, except for Tracker Riley. I remember my grandmother talking about him and other people in the town. He was quite fondly remembered. Soon after he retired in 1950, he approached his local state member, whose name was R.G. Medcalf. He was a member of the Country Party, which of course later became the National Party. And he asked Medcalf to go to Sydney to the Parliament House and make a request on his behalf that he be given a pension. He'd felt that he'd worked for 40 years, and that he deserved a pension for the work that he did. So Medcalf put this question in Parliament to the Labor Premier at the time, James McGirr, about a pension for Tracker Riley. The answer was emphatically no. McGirr stated that trackers were classed as temporary employees who did not contribute to the superannuation fund as permanent employees did, and therefore were not permitted to claim a pension. No explanation was made to the fact that trackers weren't being paid enough to have enough money to contribute to a superannuation fund. That clearly didn't bother McGirr. And he was also clearly unaware of the work that trackers had done. They were not part-time employees. They were not temporary employees. They were full-time employees. Look, trackers, in my mind, were certainly entitled to receive a pension. A claim is yet to be made on the New South Wales Police Force or the New South Wales State Government for the return or for pensions to be paid for trackers. I'm certainly glad to be here at this conference and speaking to people such as Ros Kidd and Andrew Gunston, who have experience in these matters, because I'm certainly unaware of what steps should be taken next to redress the inequities. Sadly, most trackers in New South Wales seem to have passed away. The last tracker to be employed in New South Wales retired in 1973, I'm unaware of any who are still alive. Certainly many trackers remember the careers, many families of trackers remember the careers of their fathers and grandfathers with fondness and pride. And certainly I think if something has to be done, there has to be that movement from within the community as well. And as more is known and written about the lives of trackers in New South Wales, this may happen sooner than we think. Thank you.
It's a bit of a myth about the Harvest of Judgment that it actually changed wages. That took a long time to actually effect, because the Harvest of Judgment was invalidated by the High Court initially, or at least the act under which it was made. And it took, quite a long time, not until the 1920s, really, that the Harvester Standard was widely informed. So that issue, I think, is a bit of a red herring there about wages. It wasn't that they were being denied the Harvester Standard, because the Harvester Standard was a kind of mythological standard. It wasn't actually imposed until some time later. Nevertheless, your substantive point about the gross underpayment of these wages, I think, stands. So, I wish you and other people who are working on these issues good luck with... But it does raise the point that also came up in Fiona's paper about the possibility of tort in this area. What is the capacity of various organisations to... extract these kinds of things through civil litigation? Do you have to go through these other kinds of processes, or is there a more direct route for the retrieval of these wages?
Look, that's a good question, and that's probably an area that I don't have very much experience or knowledge in, and that's why I'm going to enjoy speaking more with Ros and Andrew to see what the next best step is to take. Certainly going through the courts is a costly process, but it may well have to happen.
And actually, Michael, if I can add to that, it's a really tricky legal issue. The lawyers at the Aboriginal Legal Service in Western Australia have been working with some pro bono lawyers as well. And Ros is going to talk more about this in her paper. But when wages are... the theft of workers' money is one thing, as has happened in Queensland and has happened in Western Australia with people's pensions. But when there's this wage differential what's the legal strategy that you adopt? It's one that needs a bit more work. Obviously, the best thing would be a political solution. The best thing would be for the state governments and the territory government to actually do what the Senate recommended and set up compensation schemes, because it wouldn't be hard to work out. You know, it's just a matter of forensic accounting, like we said, who's owed money and how much.
Hi, Bava again from the Public Interest Advocacy Centre. I'm a lawyer working on these issues for my organisation with a number of pro bono firms. And I think one of the major hurdles with civil litigation is statutory time limits, which really mean that a lot of people can't even get to first base in terms of bringing a claim because they're out of time. The limits are between 3 to 6 years from when the harm or damage occurred, usually. And so when you think about when these issues came up, it's way out of time. I agree with Fiona that it's a political strategy that's needed. In New South Wales, there is a scheme to repay people money which was withheld in trust fund accounts, but of course that doesn't apply to trackers and other Aboriginal people who are underpaid. They see that as a different issue, and there's no move at the moment to address that politically. It's just a comment.
I guess that's what I'm hoping to do as well, just to expand understanding that, yes, it just wasn't the wards and the people under the controls of the Protection Board who were receiving a raw deal.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.